Okay, so thank you everyone for coming to the second talk in this distinguished visitor lecture series with Willard McCarty from King's College. We've just been trying to decide whether we should give him an elaborate introduction or not, and I think the decision is not. Although I do want to point out that Willard has a very beautiful laptop bag. I think this is something that marks in particular as a distinguished scholar in humanities computing.
Oh, since me, my distinguished bag is back of the chair. Let's see. I brought it today so that I could confuse Stan as much as the sight of his bag is.
I said, if we don't end up swapping laptops by the time he goes, I won't know the reason why. So, all right, let me turn it over to you then.
Thank you, Stan, very much, and thank you all for coming. I did wonder about the number five for the lectures I promised to give, and wondered particularly how anyone other than me would survive all five lectures. Of course, my survival is not yet demonstrated. I hope to. Anyway, today I want to ask some practical questions, though in the spirit of research rather than implementation. As kin to the engineer, I want to ask, what does our hands-on experience with design, construction, and use of tools tell us should come next? As kin to the philosopher, I want to ask, what conceptions and ways of reasoning with them has our engagement with computing shown to be most promising? As kin to the computer scientist and AI researcher, I want to ask what new forms of computing might be matched to emergent questions of criticism and how they might drive them. As kin to the cognitive scientist, I want to ask what mind and what modeling of mind might allow us readers to get closer to the machine, even intimately resonant with it. As kin to the ethnographic explorer, I want to ask at which other disciplinary ports of call I might best be spending my time. Anyhow, you get the idea. All of the disciplines are implicated. They all inform what might be done to advance literary computing, because computing touches everything we know. But note the form my statements take. They are expressions of want, meaning both need and desire. I want to ask, but don't know how. Hence the problem to which these lectures are devoted. As Clifford Geertz said about theorizing in anthropology, I am reduced to insinuating such questions because I lack the power to state them. I lack the disciplinary self-knowledge. When to speak anthropologically, we land now on one, now on another of the epistemic islands in the indefinitely expanding archipelago of disciplines. We participant observers must know who we are as much as we need to know what each group of disciplinary natives are like. Without disciplinary self-knowledge, we are close to speechless, however good we are at listening. If our game were mere poaching, such knowledge would not be required. We could just take, like others commonly do, and then live with the consequences. But because humanities computing exists primarily in relation to others, the negotiation the Australian ethnographic historian Greg Denning called beach crossing is essential. Hence the mandatory self-knowledge. More than most others, we need that historical self-awareness, and that's exactly where we falter. We do not know who we are at present because we do not know where we have been and by what paths we have arrived here, shaped by what forces and influences. In other words, we need the history hype has hidden from us, as Michael Mahoney used to insist, not an array of heroes in a timeline of progress, but a genuine history. Now, my next lecture, Writing a History, I will turn to the historiographical problem itself. In this lecture, prudence dictates that before I get started, I should shore up the bank of your patience. That's the kind of bank that water flows along, not the kind that doesn't have your money. By arguing for what otherwise seem an irrelevantly wide-wandering meander through the hinterlands of computing and beyond them, in pursuit of what I have called, with pun intended, prophets of anxiety and failure. My argument for this meander comes in two parts. The first part begins with the fact that scholars are social beings. Hence, like now, we can assume that literary computing in the period under investigation was practiced by individuals who, for the most part, lived ordinary lives in addition to their quite special professional ones. In the course of living their ordinary lives, we can further assume that they had frequent contact with sources of information, such as newspapers, magazines, radio, television, cinema, colleagues, family members, and neighbors, through which they would have become reasonably familiar with what was going on in computing and related technologies elsewhere and for other purposes. Through publications such as the Globe and Mail, Time Magazine, the Atlantic Monthly, the Times Literary Supplement, and the New Yorker, they would have known in broad terms about cybernetics, for example, even if they had not read Wiener's hugely popular and influential The Human Use of Human Beings, published in 1950. They would have seen, for example, in Life magazine, images like this. They could not have avoided what was in the air, even if they had no access to what was generating the airborne virus in departments of electrical engineering, mathematics, physics, and later computer science. Michael Mahoney has pointed out that the vivid immediacy of journalistic accounts comes at the price of perspective, if not of truth to what they report. Yet the broad influence of these accounts is difficult to gainsay, especially when, as here, the focus is on the reception history of computing. The second part of my argument for meandering begins with the grand visions and considerable fear that computing provoked. I emphasize the fear because computing, first in the form of large, expensive, closeted, and rebarbative machinery, was foreign to the humanities and so provoked considerable apprehension. I argue that historically the physical forms that computing has taken and our actual experience with these forms in hardware and the infrastructure of support were and remain fundamental to our conception of what computing is, because computing is an enigmatic and inseparable amalgam of machinery and idea and the social structures that enclose them. During the period I am considering, the origins of our machine in technoscience was a fresh fact. So also was the fact that it largely belonged to government, the military, and big business. For the entirety of this period, its development and use took place under the strange and pervasive influence of the Cold War from 1945 to 1991, with threat of nuclear annihilation that, Paul N. Edwards persuasively argues, could only be known as a computational simulation, that is, as a nightmarish science fiction more real than the reality itself, because actual outcomes, as he says, had become too enormous to be comprehended and too dangerous to be tested. As I will argue later, the closed world Edwards describes was not the whole world, but its ability to create powerful alternative realities, one suspects, made wild statements of what might be done much easier to entertain. The Canadian philosopher Francis Sparshot proposed, perhaps not coincidentally toward the end of the Cold War, that we consider the actual world simply the possible world we happen to be in. From the late 1950s onward, when the Sage computerized air defense system shown here first entered the public imagination, a possible world we could be in, though very briefly, was close enough to allow for what Edwards has called a politics of subjectivity. The computer-generated electronic battlefield of Vietnam was the real world in which so many lived and died. I am not, please note, arguing for a causal relation between such powerful military fantasies and computing as it was in the daily life of scholars. I am arguing for its virtually unavoidable influence. At a time when the indefinitely expansive and expanding possibilities of computing were developing, its rapid technological development, open-ended experimental style, and spectacular successes during these first two decades gave strong encouragement to those who wished to project visionary futures. In the humanities, where problems are far less amenable and the ways of going about them so different, grand visions tended to provoke strongly negative reactions that illumine the claims being made. Little of this got into the specialist literature, of course, where it is not polite to be openly nervous. Mostly it is found on the periphery in direct attacks from a traditional disciplinary heartland and to reverse the polarity in promotional advocacy from early adopters. What we do find in the literature when the practitioner looks up from his or her workbench are relatively small hints of this much more extensive situation, hints which the governing decorum makes far more significant than otherwise. They are hints we are likely to overlook unless somehow forewarned. My contention is that a genuine history of what happened in literary computing cannot be written without taking these hints into account and allowing their implications to inform the specialist literature rather than glossing them over. Without them, I argue, we cannot properly understand the choices practitioners made and the choices they did not make. Hence, we cannot see the unspoken alternatives or understand the cogency of those that were offered and rejected. Without them, the small history of literary computing remains small, provincial, unconnected to the developments in the wider world, and so incoherent and inexplicable. The chronology of its events may be relatively unproblematic, but its history without them and that to which they lead is impossible. To illustrate, I begin with one of the best-known expressions of visionary enthusiasm from the early years of artificial intelligence: Herbert Simons and Alan Newell's confident prediction of achievements, quote, to be realized within the next 10 years, that is, by the year 1968. Here I am not concerned with these predictions as such. Rather, I want to focus on the emphatic assertion that lies behind them. This is most clearly and revealingly stated in Simons' lecture notes for his earlier lecture to the Operations Research Society of America on 14th November 1957. There he writes, partly in TypeScript, partly by hand, with underscoring and exclamation points, put it bluntly, hard now to shock, machines think, learn, create. The naked passion is remarkable, especially when you consider that this is not any ordinary enthusiast, but one of those whose ideas shaped the course and nature of computing. He was also awarded the Nobel Prize for Economics in 1978. Much could be and should be said and shown concerning the rhetoric and imagery of the thinking machine and electronic brain during this time in the popular press. I will return to a larger fraction of it later. For now, however, let me offer two images, both of them from the covers of Time magazine, both showing an anthropomorphized machine concerned only with itself. The first is dated 23rd January 1950, showing a machine in military dress with the subtitle, Can Man Build a Superman? The second, dated 2nd April 1965, shows a giant mainframe cum cerebral cortex served by a buxom redhead and a young man with a group of five older scientists poring over the printout entitled The Computer in Society. These are not in any way atypical images. About the same time as this, IBM sponsored what seems to have been the first conference for computing in the humanities, the Conference on Literary Data Processing, September 1964, in Yorktown Heights, New York. In his review of this conference, the editor of the Journal of Higher Education, historian Franklin J. Pegues, declared that, quote, the purpose of the machine is not to dehumanize the humanities, but to free the humanist for the important work of literary criticism by providing him with large and accurate masses of data that may be used by him in the work which only he can accomplish. This is hardly a controversial statement for the time, or perhaps even now, but there are two very important clues in it. Pegway's assertion that computers perform what is, in effect, and is called elsewhere, drudgery, and his assertion that to the reader that the human critic retains a unique, irreplaceable role in criticism. I will return to the question of drudgery later. My question for now is, why should anyone want to insist on the critic's uniqueness? Unless, Thanks to the ambient belief in claims such as Simon's, literary critics were at some level genuinely worried. And let us note what they were worried about. Certainly not, as they are, should be now, their usefulness to society, which was then not in question, rather their existential status as critics. 5 years later, appearing on the front page of the Times Literary Supplement for 23rd April 1970, is the text of a public lecture given at the University of Bristol by the literary critic and public intellectual F.R. Leavis, Literarism versus Scientism, The Misconception and the Menace. 8 years earlier, Leavis had earned himself much notoriety by his ad hominem attack in a lecture entitled Two Cultures, The Significance of C.P. Snow. Among other things, he portrayed Snow as a portent of the cultural threat posed by the technological revolution. In some ways a counterpart to Leavis, Lord Snow was also a novelist as well as a public intellectual, who at the time of the attack had written 9 novels, went on to write 7 more, and to receive a Booker Prize nomination for Best Novel. In one of many intemperate moments, Leavis jokingly alleged that his opponent's novels had been composed by an electronic brain called Charlie, Leavis said, which is revealing given Leavis's fear that computing would redefine and so cripple human culture. This fear he developed in his public lecture at Bristol, but in a considerably more subtle argument that he had used on Snow, which got him into an awful lot of trouble. In the light of what British higher education has become, it is difficult to disagree with his gloomy forecast for it, which is remarkably accurate. Leavis was also admirably sensitive to the Pegways-like reassurance with which he began his lecture, quoting from an earlier article in the DLS, which declared that, quote, the computer can in no way lift the responsibility from human shoulders. The interesting question is why readers would need such a reassurance. Leavis's answer is that the educated and cultivated have, in general, given in, as he said, surrendered to the climate of the technological age. The example of surrender that concerns us most here is the one he illustrated with 2 anecdotes about his encounter with the claim, by then quite current, that, quote, a computer can write a poem, end quote. The first anecdote involves the director of a London art gallery who became angry, fierce, and authoritative when Leavis challenged him. The second, a philosopher, a lady, and cultivated, who turned aside Leavis's objection with amusement. Both for him signaled profound misunderstanding of poetry caused by, quote, the professional subhumanities of computerial addiction, as he says. Interest in poetry writing by machine, now all but vanished, was then an active line of research, for example, by Margaret Masterman and others at the Cambridge Language Research Unit, with the aim of developing an interactive tool for poets. She wrote about it as early as 1964 in an article in the Times Literary Supplement shown here, advocating a gayer and yet more creative use of the machine than merely as a scientific instrument that, she said, some thought to be a mark of doom, a symbol of man's increasing servitude to the machine. The clues here are these. Again, the reassurance of human uniqueness, and so identity, responding to the possibility of its corruption or loss, and the pairing of desire and fear. I turn now to an article entitled Fear and Trembling, The Humanist Approaches the Computer, published in College Composition and Communication by Ellen W. Nold in 1975. Nold starts by expressing a double bind of anxiety. She is frightened, she says, by the passivity of frightened colleagues who believe, as she quotes one of them saying, that computers and television seem to control our thinking or to make us passive in our concerns about the human condition. Note that here, in contrast to Leavis's analysis, passivity has switched sides from surrender to a slothful failure to embrace the machine. Her response to such unconscionable lack of initiative and creativity is through her computer-assisted teaching. She provides selections from dialogues between students and the computer, These are strongly reminiscent of Joseph Weizenbaum's Eliza, which he trotted out in 1964, an interactive program that simulated a non-directive psychoanalyst and got many people very strangely hooked. With such imaginative programming, she asserts, the computer might, quote, multiply the good and wondrous in man, end quote, rather than impose, as she feared, a program of behaviorists and others who demean the human mind. Those are her words. What prevents her colleagues from multiplying the good, she argues, is that they who master difficult languages without fuss refuse to learn, quote, the far more logical, far less capricious language of the machine, end quote. Clearly, Nold is strongly attracted to the computer's algorithmic clarity. But what helps us make most sense of her perspective is, together with what she says and her seriousness in saying it, the allusion of her title, Fear and Trembling, to the title of Søren Kierkegaard's existential classic, Frit och Bävan, published in 1843, Fear and Trembling. The drama of computing, she seems to imply, is a psychomachia, a struggle for human identity. Note that there is not a hint that she is being cute or playful. She admits being afraid of what she sees her colleagues not doing and openly expresses Edenic possibilities for humanity. Those of us old enough to remember 1975 will know that her fears and enthusiasms were everywhere. Consider now what Stanley Fish, in his well-known attack on computational stylistics 6 years later in 1981, saw as the essential problem. Quote, a desire and fear, he proclaims. The desire to be relieved of the burden of interpretation by handing it over to an algorithm, and the fear of being left alone with the self-renewing and unquantifiable power of human signifying. Whether he is being fair to those he attacks, I don't think he is beside the point I am making. What matters is the psychomachia he sees being waged. Again, we meet the imputation that a computer might handle the drudgery, although now, more radically, all of interpretation is drudgery to the kind of scholar he is condemning. But what is being desired and what feared? Much the same thing, I would think. Again, a kind of sloth. But unlike Nold's passivity, this sloth takes refuge in hardware rather than goes limp in fear of it. We have enough now, I think, to get some idea of the swirling confusion in which computing humanists encountered the machine, a dialectic of desire and fear that in that encounter and its potential seriousness. I'm not suggesting that the psychomachia was a conscious affair for all or even many academics, or even that it disturbed their sleep. We must be able to distinguish, I think, on the one hand, the paranoid's vision of necessity, on the other, the pervasive but often unnoticed influence that, like wind or water, bends or wears away, seemingly unaffected, in different solidities. But computing was, in fact, quite noticeable. Its wildfire onset during this time, the degree of academic hype as well as enthusiasm, the equally strong, sometimes fearful, rejection of it, and the studied lack of curiosity all suggest that I am not asking silly questions. Evident worries are traces of a restless and deep uncertainty. The drama of this drama, however, isn't all. The three I's, as I call them, ignorance, incomprehension, and indifference, can be as telling as the turbulence of fear and desire. Hence the question I pursue in the fourth lecture, but not today. Why were humanist scholars not at least openly curious about the thoughts that had become newly thinkable, or thinkable in a different way? Forgive me for postponing that question. At the beginning of considering literary computing from 1949 to 1991, one certainly gets the impression that written text was regarded as the low-hanging fruit in the digital harvest, as I said yesterday, especially if you were working in English or Latin. As with musical notation, for the majority of languages where computing had traveled, much of the work of encoding seemed already to have been done by virtue of alphabetization and by the conventions established over millennia for markup, as Jerry McGann calls it in the pre-computational sense. The idea of tools for manipulating textual data to decode their meaning had been a major focus of research efforts in espionage during World War II. The fundamental idea of their manipulation had been established well before that recent war by a group of Dominicans at Saint-Jacques in Paris, who in the 13th century invented the concordance, drawing on a structural principle for the discovery of meaning at least as old as the Hebrew Bible. We might almost say that computer-assisted concordancing came naturally, or as close to natural as intentional action gets, although in fact its automation was at the time a great technical achievement, of which some were sufficiently proud to include flowcharts of the software in their printed concordances. Thomas Sebiok is one of those, by the way. From our perspective, at least, the conceptual distance between what computers could easily do and what early scholars were already inclined to do was small. The fact that that he was working with the Latin of St. Thomas Aquinas for his great Index Thomisticus project meant that Bouza had to face the somewhat more sophisticated, but still largely mechanical task of lemmatization far more seriously than those working in English. Most of the great work he did was not unprecedented, however. It was a product of his time and his intellectual culture, as well as his invention. Thanks to our colleague Edward Van Hoot, we know to look also to the machine translation project for a parallel case, indeed remarkably parallel. The story begins in 1947 with an exchange of letters between Warren Weaver and Norbert Wiener. Concerned, like many, with conditions for world peace, Weaver pointed to the problem of translation, asking Wiener if he thought, quote, it were unthinkable to design a computer which would translate, end of quote. Wiener, who had much more sensitivity to the demands of language than many of those involved in machine translation, replied that the prospects were not hopeful because of the difficulties ordinary language presented. In a widely circulated and influential memorandum on the subject written about 2 years later, Weaver quoted from the exchange, concluded that the technical literature might be more amenable, and sketched ways of attacking the scaled-down problem. By then, the Cold War was in progress. For Americans especially, the Cold War furnished an enemy whose daily linguistic production needed translating quickly and cheaply, and so for researchers in machine translation, abundant funding was not difficult to get. The gravy train continued until 1966, when the whistle was blown by the Automatic Language Processing Advisory Committee in its report, Language and Machines, Computers in Translation and Linguistics, formerly known as the ALPAC Report, informally as the Black Book on Machine Translation. It concluded that translation could be done as cheaply by humans, and that by far the most important outcome of all the work so handsomely funded was the effect of machine translation research on linguistics, that is, the creation of a new research field, computational linguistics. As Bouza said, and has been demonstrated many times since, the primary contribution of modeling a cultural artifact or other complex object with a computer is to raise the question of how that artifact or object is understood. The point is not the gizmo, but what the gizmo fails to accomplish, and by that failure illumines. By the mid-1960s, signs of trouble with early visions of what computing might do were becoming visible. In machine translation, considerably before ALPAC, as York Wilkes points out, and in artificial intelligence, by the time of Hubert Dreyfus's RAND report, Alchemy and Artificial Intelligence, 1965, in which he reviewed the rash predictions that Simon had first made in his lecture of 1957. In her delightful book, Machines Who Think, Pamela McCordick marshals the defense for AI, which in essence is very much in line with Bouza's argument for literary and linguistic computing and ALPAC's for machine translation. What matters most, she argues, are the questions being asked and their refinement in research, not the distressingly frequent failures to realize predictions and meet targets. One cannot but help think that the pitch for support based on usefulness entails expectation that the targets will be met, however. And given the kind of questioning I am engaged with, I cannot help but point to the anxieties which have dogged artificial intelligence from Dreyfus's defamation in 1965 to fears openly expressed in the present day. For example, in the public reaction to questions raised at the 2009 ASILOMAR conference convened by the Association for the Advancement of Artificial Intelligence. So, What about literary computing? In the 1962 articles which I have referred, Masterman argued that a purely menial tool, as she called it, helps the scholar by performing for him a series of irksome, repetitive tasks, but provokes no new theoretic vision. 4 years later, in the lead article in the inaugural issue of the first journal in our field, Computers and the Humanities, the literary critic Joseph Millich declared that, quote, "We are still not thinking of the computer as anything but a myriad of clerks or assistants in one convenient console," and then called for a truly imaginative next step, despite the odium that had greeted earlier attempts. He went on, quote, "These and other creative uses are trials of strength, estimates of capability, whose ultimate purpose," he said, "was to achieve greater intimacy with the creative process." For literary scholars, he argued, computing was not about the machine's servitude, but about its participant enabling of criticism. Quote, "Our fear that the study of literature may become mechanical if it is processed by a computer," end quote, he wrote, "has kept us from trying to understand its rich and genuine possibilities. Unless we try to understand it in the way in which, as scholars, we try to comprehend any of our tools, we shall not only be incapable of exploiting its resources properly, but we shall be in danger of becoming its victims." A few years later, in a review of books on the social impact of computing, the pioneering systems scientist Sir Charles Jeffrey Vickers used starker language to identify the central error inhibiting work on realizing Masterman's new theoretic vision. "To succumb to the dangerously strong temptation of the amoral slave labor on offer," he wrote, "would bury computing's intellectual potential." More later about the menial. Meanwhile, in 1964, at the IBM Literary Data Processing Conference, the critic Efim Fogel was promoting the analgesic notion of a vision actuality interval, that is, the time interval between the investigator's rational belief, his vision, that present knowledge and technical resources enable one to produce certain theoretical or practical consequences, and the actual production of those consequences. Potential wasn't being realized, but the fact of Fogel's analgesic gesture points to more, again, a sense of unease. The most damning sentence, however, remains Roseanne Potter's from the preface to Literary Computing and Literary Criticism, published in 1989. "Literary computing," she wrote, "remains outside the recognized mainstream. It has not been rejected, but rather neglected." The most insightful of all the assessments before Jerome McGann's in 2004 was Susan Wittig's in 1978 in The Computer and the Concept of Text, in which she recognizes that the use of the computer, as she says, has added immeasurably to the ability of literary analysts to perform better and more efficiently the same tasks that they had performed for many years, but that it has not enlarged our range of vision or radically changed for us the shape of the universe of aesthetic discourse. She explains by pointing to the positivistic idea of text implicit in the limited conceptual framework of new criticism. Hence what I have called the Wittig-McGann question, for McGann began asking exactly this question 20 years later. What is text? Sir Anthony Kenny, in his British Library lecture of 1992, brushes the issue when he quotes Robert Connor, the classicist, on computing in classical studies. Quote, "Computer technology," Connor observes, "became available precisely at the wrong moment in the profession's development, when the strong emphasis on lexical and textual studies had largely passed." Kenny wonders if this is a coincidence. I suspect, rather, it is just the kind of reaction to the cultural juggernaut of computing to which the clues that I have been fingering lead. We have been, as Wittig wrote 32 years ago, stalled on the threshold ever since. It would seem that literary computing was imprinted with the literary theoretical assumptions closest to computing at the time of its origins. These still seem right to those charmed by the notion that the text we read is simply positively out there on the page, that with more funding we'll build better tools to process it, produce discipline-altering results, and so persuade the scholarly masses at long last to join us few. But it's been clear for decades that the central question about text to which computing leads, what is text, remains poorly answered. The fruit beyond reach we may dream of, sometimes even think we see, but we have no idea of how to construct a ladder that will allow us to reach it. To my knowledge, there have been two major attempts. The first, with which the text encoding initiative is intimately associated, is the hypothesis that text is, as Alan Rainier has argued, an ordered hierarchy of content objects. That's jargon for having the structural form of a legal document, which is exactly the kind of text originally in view by the lawyer Charles Goldfarb, who invented its ancestor, the general markup language, in 1969. It must be said that for many industrial and commercial purposes, chiefly in publishing, the answer serves remarkably well, especially since the TEI published its guidelines. It fails us, however, as soon as our concern shifts from producing standardized texts to reading them. The shift isn't really from the mechanical to human text processing. Rather, it is from one sense of text to another. The difference between them is closely analogous to the difference between the technical sense of information defined by Claude Shannon in 1948 and the earlier sense of communicated and therefore meaningful knowledge. As Warren Weaver foresaw in the book he subsequently co-authored with Shannon, published in 1949, in the discourse of computing, the difference between information and knowledge has been so blurred as almost to have vanished. And with it, the difference between writings produced according to a formal template and literature properly so called. Although the jargonistic formula ordered hierarchy of content objects is too strict, even for the legal document type that Charles Goldfarb had in mind when he designed the ancestor of XML, legal documents are in fact meaningful. The poorness of the fit is easy to ignore, but for texts which manifest the full range of imaginative language, the idea of text this formula proposes is radically, obviously inadequate. This may sound like it leads to reader response criticism, but the dead hand of behaviorism and the positivistic construction of what and where the stimulating text to which readers are responding is lies heavily on reader response model. Reading does not come after the text as a response, Jerome McGann points out in Black Writers. Reading is the correspondence which writing has already foretold. A hint of a better answer has been available implicitly as long as tools have been in use, for computing as long as computers. As the historian David Mindell has shown, it was implicit in the engineering cultures which preceded cybernetics. It was articulated vociferously, though out of the mainstream, by the early computer hackers at MIT, the Tech Model Railroad Club, as the hands-on imperative. It was developed by Douglas Engelbart in Augmenting Human Intellect, published in 1962. It gained theoretical and philosophical treatment in Terry Winograd and Fernando Flores' Computers and Cognition, published in 1986. It is resonant with and strengthened by the arguments for embodied knowledge in cognitive science and philosophy, and by work more generally in the thing knowledge of instruments. In literary computing, perhaps the best implicit illustration is the work of John Burroughs, whose alternation between literary understanding and statistical experiment, though at a pace set by an antiquated idea of computing, points the way forward. My ideas for a way forward form the subject for my last lecture. Here I want to conclude by relating the notions of computing as drudgery and the master-slave dialectic to the idea of computing that we have carried with us from the time when computers were distant, slow, rebarbative, and someone else's property. From the European age of discovery onward, the increasing demands for numerical calculations created the role of the human computer and made him or her a drudge, or feel like a drudge, that is, in the OED definition, one employed in mean, servile, or distasteful work, a slave, a hack, a hard toiler. From the 17th century on, navigation for commercial and military purposes and then industrialization increasingly depended on accurate mathematical tables, the production of which meant, as Charles Babbage wrote in his appeal to the then new president of the Royal Society, Sir Humphrey Davy, in 1822, quote, "the intolerable labor and fatiguing monotony of a continued repetition of similar arithmetical calculations." He knew from long experience that such labor induced wearisomeness and disgust, wasting precious talent on one of the lower operations of human intellect. Hence, as his grandson Richard said to the Symposium on Large-Scale Digital Calculating Machinery at Harvard in 1947, Babbage directed his efforts to reproduce in mechanism the human faculties of memory and foresight so as to free mankind from the heavy brain drudgery of computing, proofreading, and correcting the mathematical aids to navigation and commerce. The drudgery to which Babbage responded was real, but what concerns me more is the link he and others forged between computing and servility. Both Blaise Pascal and Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz had done likewise. Leibniz had declared in his description of his own and Pascal's machines that, quote, "It is unworthy of excellent men to lose hours like slaves in the labor of calculation, horas servile calculandi labore perire, which could be relegated to anyone else, vilissimo cuiuque, if the machine were used." The same frustration was uttered by many others for whom laborious calculations slowed down or blocked the research they wanted to do. We can easily sympathize, but Leibniz's declaration hints at something in addition with which we cannot or should not sympathize. Not just freedom given to excellent men so that they may accomplish worthier things, but with the help of the machine, relegation of servile labor, vilissimo cuiuque, which I translate more pointedly to anyone of the commonest sort, i.e., those who are to these excellent men as pucks, rude mechanicals, are to the nobility in A Midsummer Night's Dream. This relegation has proved remarkably persistent. When in the 1950s computing machinery was commercialized and became widely available, relegation took hold in a gradually developing hierarchy that put researchers on top, computer operators at the bottom, and programmers in between. Thus, the job of IBM and its machines may have been, as Thomas J. Watson Jr. said, quote, "to make automatic a lot of things now done by slow and laborious human drudgery," end quote. The supposed easing of the human burden was, however, accomplished not by abolishing, but by changing the kind of drudgery and shifting it within universities to computing centers where techies comprised a new social underclass. It was then commonplace for computer operators to wear white lab coats, as I did when I worked in the machine room of a computing center in Berkeley, California, which simultaneously designated their technical role and, like the livery of servants, effaced their identities. To this day, technical staff are effaced by the services they perform. My concern here is not so much with the social trade-offs accompanying and affected by computerization, a story well beyond my scope and brilliantly told, for example, by Shoshana Zuboff's In the Age of the Smart Machine, published in 1988. Rather, my concern is with the notion that computing is for relief from drudgery, that its purpose is to do what we don't want to do so that we can devote ourselves to something that curiously is seldom articulated in arguments for automation, promising leisure. We may think of something worthy for a free human being, something cognitively higher, something imaginative, or if we are workers, to a state of leisure defined just as vaguely or negatively as cessation from work, rest, careless diversion, often slumber, like my neighbor in London. But in either case, work, which can be ennobling, is relegated to silence. And it in turn silences. To the degree we regard precision as a defining quality of truthfulness, the blurring of precision and computation into synonymy renders the worthy imaginative life from one side speechless and from the other side inaudible. The question then is, and is again, one of language. Presuming that we view software, like mathematics more generally, as an imaginative language, how do we speak with it to the concerns of literary criticism? What language can criticism use without traducing those concerns to speak imaginatively in software? In these lectures, I'm asking the question historically so that we may understand what happened in the incunabular years so that we can do something in the present. I will consider it again at some length in the fourth lecture by following closely Ivar Richards' argument on just this topic to the cyberneticists at the 1951 Macy Conference, as I mentioned at the beginning. Tomorrow, however, I turn aside to consider more theoretically what sort of argument I myself am making. Thank you very much.
I think we have time, maybe three or four questions.
We have 15 minutes, according to my clock. Jeffrey.
I'm almost full of questions here.
You're a philosopher, you have to be.
I have to be.
I once heard philosophy defined as the discipline that contains the history of contention.
and we contain it so well. I want to contend with you about your characterization of the TI and the ordered hierarchy. You seem to sort of set up, as I think many people are, sort of demonizing the work of the TEI as some sort of limited thing. When I go back and read Rainier et al., that article, What is Text Really? The first one, they do make, the objective claim that, you know, a text is X. But in the second one, they make a very interesting shift. They start out with the first claim, and then they notice how it's limited. And they switch to a shift of saying a perspective on text is. So it's no longer a claim. In effect, what they're saying is that an ordered hierarchy of content objects is one way of interpreting a text, which is something Michael Sperber Queen has also said, that all markup is interpretation. And yet you and Jerome McGann still go after them as straw men, I think, and sort of suggesting that there's something so much richer and deeper that we would call interpretation, when in fact that's what they've said in the first place. This is one way to interpret a phenomenon, a fairly platonic way of interpreting a phenomenon, but one way to do it.
The ghost of Plato rolls in his grave.
Yes.
No, I mean, it is a perspective on text. It's just that the recognition of how limited it is, I don't see forthcoming. And I don't see the recognition, maybe I've just missed the key piece of writing. I don't see the recognition that TEI has a place in the world, and its place is thus and so. I mean, they go round and round and round about the overlapping hierarchies argument as if it were a tiny little unimportant thing that could get tidied away sometime when we get clever enough. But it seems to me that that's, you know, one of many problems. It's fine as long as, you know, it's done wonderful work for the provision of text to be read. That's really my point. It's provision of text to be read. It's great. It's the biggest achievement of humanity's computing, I think. I think everybody recognizes that. It's just that I don't want the far greater country beyond to be just lost to sight, that's the limit of what we can do with a few, like, you know, the state of physics at the end of the 19th century, a few unimportant problems will tidy away when we get around to it. Those few unimportant problems are, as Jerry says, the hem of a quantum garment. You touch that hem and the whole world changes. The whole universe expands. And it's that expanded sense of what literature is, but I think it just gets lost to view.
So I guess I want to suggest that there's, I think Rainier's, the follow-on article, I think he says quite clearly, OCO does not do it all. In fact, it does really a very narrow thing. I mean, I think Rainier, at least, is quite clear of the limitations. Where I guess I would agree with you is that then there's the social question of the TEI as a consortium and how it has behaved. I think the enforcement of the OCO model has not come so much in the writings of people like Rainier as in the politics, if you will.
Yes, yeah. Oh, Alan is a philosopher whom I respect. I love to talk with him because he is every bit as able to recognize the fuzzy periphery of what he's done as anyone. It's not a personal attack at all. It's just this idea let loose in the world gets assumed by people that really feel uncomfortable with what literature does. And so they put on their blazer with you know, TEI on the here, and they enforce conformity, and they talk about, as Michael Sperber-Queen has said, the realities of living with the TEI. There are two things that one lives with. One is TEI and one is cancer. And it's a very unfortunate choice of phrase. And forgive me if I'm so obsessive about language that I go straight for the throat when I hear phrases like that, which seem to be a kind of implicit recognition that there is something wrong here. There's something being forgotten that needs to be recognized. And perhaps, I mean, I'm deliberately being provocative because this debate is what it's all about.
So, can I ask a different question? Can you go back a couple of slides to that one, that lovely one you had of the end, that one? So,
oh, yes.
That one right there. So, I'm struck, and here I really have to thank Sophia. Sophia has drawn my attention to the gendered nature of this.
Well, why do you think I chose it?
Well,
the one man in the picture is the one who is the supervisor.
Who's leaning over. But I guess I was expecting you to go, especially with that picture. I was expecting you to say that, well, in fact, a lot of what was happening in terms of automating drudgery and creating this new class, where we were automating out a class of work that was actually work with dignity for women. It may not have had as much dignity as some of the men's careers possible, but it was one of the, along with nursing and teaching, of one of the sort of career possibilities. We automated that out of existence and replaced it, as I understand it, from especially in the business community, we replaced it with this new category of work that was restricted to men called programming.
Well, it's a very complex story, and I just brushed quickly. I tossed this image out to suggest that line of thought, but didn't develop it, just limitation of time. I think in The Human Use of Human Beings, I think it's there, Norbert Wiener says that anyone now, and he's writing in the 50s, anyone now who has only muscle power to offer is useless to society. And the terrible resonances of that for both men and women are everywhere around us. I mean, I live next door to an example of this uselessness. Sorry to drag my domestic affairs into the academic lecture, but it is illustrative of this very problem of enormous changes in society that are having and continue to have all sorts of consequences.
Okay. Throw something into that. I've been doing a lot of research lately on my grandfather, Robert C. Binkley, who in the 1930s was a pioneer of microfilm. And had he lived past 1940, I'm sure he would have picked up the computer revolution. And in the mid-30s, he came up with a scheme to use unemployed white-collar workers in the service of local history, which led to the Historical Records Survey in the States. Get these unemployed clerical workers to go to the courthouses and index all the documents, all the records of archival materials and so on, and also to get them to index and abstract newspapers, all in the service of history. And so the same dichotomy between the historian, the PhD who's going to write the book, and the clerical worker who's going to do the drudgery. But he doesn't call it drudgery. He tries very hard to hold up the dignity of these workers. He compares them. The clerical comes from the clericus of Charlemagne's age, the educated person who can work with documents, and that is the key skill they bring. They know how to look at a document and make an abstract of it, to type up the results. They've got the physical skills of running a typewriter. All of which contrasts very strongly with, and he refers to them as he clearly has in mind male clerical workers who have been thrown out of work by the Depression. So the dichotomy between the social sciences on his side and the hard sciences, where these women are doing the calculations that led to the Manhattan Project and so on, along with this issue between male work and female work in this context, is very interesting. I wish he had lived into the computer age to see where he would have taken some of this stuff.
So do I. Then you could talk about his reflections.
Yeah. I want to switch the subject to the Cold War.
Yeah.
The news recently, the U.S. has signed an agreement with Russia to reduce nuclear weapons, right? I mean, it seems to me that the bomb, whichever version of the bomb, is at the center of the Cold War, continues to define U.S. foreign policy. And I'm wondering about, you know, in the work you're doing, if you've come across instances that equate computing with the bomb. I mean, you were sort of moving in that direction in some of the things you were saying. But it seems to me that's part of the fear and anxiety. You know, I mean, it's the bomb, right?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I mean, the computing was necessary in order, as I understand it, during the Manhattan Project. Who was it? One of the major physicists, Fermi, perhaps, hypothesized that exploding the first nuclear bomb would ignite the atmosphere, and the calculations necessary to show that this wouldn't happen, and which therefore gave the green light to develop the bomb for military purposes, that required computing machinery. But what I'm trying to get my head around and trying to get my mouth around in these lectures is the complexity of the various confluent streams of this history, which is exactly why I chose that image. That there are many things going on simultaneously. The problem with Paul N. Edwards' brilliant book, The Closed World, is that its historiography, as I said yesterday, explains too much. It does depict a closed world, but you forget that the closed world isn't the only world, and that there are many things going on simultaneously which are not causally related. Or maybe a social scientist tried to wriggle out of causality by saying they're covariant. They're going on at the same time, and they seem to be in step with each other. That the development of computing and the development of the bomb are, I am tempted to say, they're cognate phenomena. But that's not a very satisfactory way of solving the historiographical problem of how these things are related. You say down where we can't see it, out of sight somewhere, there's a common cause. But I'm getting increasingly less satisfied with that. We need some other way of doing history. David Mindell's history of the engineering before cybernetics is a brilliant example of how to tell a history properly so that you never make those causal connections, or you're very careful when you make them. You just lay out all the things going on and say, behold, as in those confluent streams and rivulets and marshes in that image.
Wait, just one quick follow-up. I work on the Cold War in a way, trying to understand how it shapes the literary study in Canada in the post-war period. So I think you and I could probably talk, but within 10 kilometers of us, there are all sorts of bomb shelters built by people in the city, fearful of, and trying to get a sense of as you say, of the connection, but also of the of the felt, of the fear. And as you say, I think it's inextricably bound up in their sense of technology and computing.
As a school child in grade school, I regularly went through a drill of duck and cover, crawl under the desk and do this to protect against the nuclear attack.
I mean, I could take you on a tour of bomb shelters in the city.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
Individuals who build them themselves, some of them built with government grants, but many people just built them out of fear, right? I mean, and stalked them. How do you get a sense of that?
Right? Yeah. And as you can see, I'm interested in the relationship between that fear, which was everywhere, and what was going on in this tiny little group of literary specialists playing with computers who were, ducking and covering, or their children were, and whose children were playing with digital computer kits, which you could buy from the mid-1950s to build your own digital circuitry. It's complete instructions on how to build a digital computer. All of this in the mix. The tremendous and challenging problem is trying to make that picture without oversimplifying it.
Yeah, so your image is perfect.
Yes. I look at that image quite a lot. I also think of rope making as the intertwining and disentangling of threads of a rope. Just trying to get an image that will keep me honest as I work on this stuff. But we should talk more about the Cold War.
It's a delight to hear somebody else struggling with very similar problems.
Yeah.
A quick one that you don't necessarily have to answer right now. But I'm thinking about these and sort of the images that you showed about the ways in which, and that we've been talking about before, women's work is getting replaced by computers and this anxiety about drudgery and eliminating drudgery. And I'm thinking back even further to like the Luddites, for example, at the beginning of the 19th century when textile looms are replacing workers. So how does this fit into a larger question about social class and about pitching the working class as a problem that needs to be solved in some way? The problem of the working class can get solved by replacing them with these other machines, and then the next step. But the next step is always kind of left blank, right? So I guess it's about social class and how the work that you're doing fits into these maybe bigger questions about the problems about the proletariat.
Shoshana Zuboff's book that I cited is the best treatment I've run across so far. But in the report by the Trades Union Congress in England in 1954, the fear of what computing was going to do to the working man was being expressed by working men at the time. The image on the cover of this report, you can find all the stuff online, is a giant metallic-looking robot with a worker, with his worker's cap, kneeling before the big machine. And it says, man or machine, ? There were debates running through the 50s. Simultaneous with debates about getting 50% of students into higher education, by the way, of what this was going to do to the working man, and reports that I have yet to investigate that said, no, it's all right. It's been shown that this is not going to take your job away. Simultaneous with Norbert Wiener saying, you're useless. You have nothing more to contribute to society, just muscle power. It's a very complicated story, and it is. I remain convinced that it is necessary to articulate at least some part of that story in order to paint the immediate background in which these literary computing sorts were working. They must have lived next door to some people. Perhaps less communication in the UK, but certainly a lot of the awareness of this threat to the working man. Whether there was, high-level plummy discussions of how to solve the problem of the working class this way, I don't know. I haven't run across anything like that. Those things don't tend not to get written down. But it's a necessary story to be told. And about as far as I've gotten so far is just what I said, this trade union Congress stuff. And Shoshana Zuboff's brilliant book, In the Age of the Smart Machine.
Some of the teaching that I do, and I'm prepping for some teaching next year, it's interesting to me that sort of at the beginning of the industrial period and the rise of science, we get all of these anxieties that show up at almost exactly the same time. It's kind of anxiety about the lower classes and the relationship between them and the upper classes. These anxieties about work and these anxieties about knowledge and scientific knowledge and who gets to produce it, and they all kind of show up at the same time. And the anxieties about human dignity and the relationship between humans and technology, and I mean the easy answer is that, well, it's just products of the Industrial Revolution and all these things are happening at the same time. But I think that's why your strategy is much better, right? The sort of other kind of historiography where you connect all of these things in ways that don't oversimplify that relationship.
It just makes the job 100 times more difficult.
Yeah.
To underestimate the difficulty. In the 1980s, when I had already my PhD and was working at a non-academic job because there were no jobs in Milton Studies at the time, I was setting up equipment for Robert Hollander, professor of comparative literature at Princeton. I was in shirt sleeves and it was a Toronto summer day, so it was very sticky and sweaty. And I was setting up this equipment, and Hollander was talking to me clearly as if I were a rude mechanical. So I quoted some Latin at him, and he changed his tone just like that. And we became friends, and I recently spoke to him. He's a wonderful man, but the social stratification, which its sudden change with a few words of Latin, is a kind of anecdote, is an anecdote which reflects that whole history of the separation between rude mechanicals and the nobility from the time of Shakespeare and much before. The association of actual work with the lower class and the lack of work, the existence above all work of the upper classes is with us today. Go to any computing center site at a university and try to find who works there and what they do. Go to any academic department at any university and look at it, and what do you find front and center? The people. So the people in the computing center, they may have PhDs, but they're obscured. Princeton is a good example of this. And that maybe I'm just being paranoid, but because I was in that position for so long. But it does seem to me to be a playing out of this very same social class problem, reinforced by the tenure system in North America, very reinforced by the tenure system, that we really need to do something about. And in one of the subsequent lectures, I quote the Yale professor of history of religion, Yaroslav Pelikan, who said in the 1992, I think, that it is time we recognize as a matter of justice and a matter of courtesy that we are all colleagues in the research enterprise. Now, exactly how you implement that within a university structure is another matter I'll leave to your provost to think about.
Glad you're not leaving that one to me.
We should probably stop there. 10 after 12. Thank you again.
Thank you.